If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, February the 12th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Joining me today in studio here on the Stanford University campus is Victor Davis Hanson. He is the Martin and Illy Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution with a focus on classics and military history. Victor is the author of hundreds of articles, book reviews, and newspaper editorials on Greek, agrarian, and military history, and essays on contemporary culture. He's a syndicated columnist whose writing also appears in the National Review and American Greatness. Victor Davis Hanson is also a man of the land, a historian who returned to his family's farming roots, growing raisins in the Central Valley. Victor, it's good to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
So today let's talk about someone who also was a farmer but didn't have a Stanford PhD but somehow managed to get himself for the news, and that was Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
Born on this day 200 years ago in a one-room log cabin that's about an hour's drive south of Louisville in what was then very rural Kentucky. I look at Lincoln's birthday, Victor, and the first thing I see is messy government. Very few states celebrate his birthday on February the 12th. Most lump it into President's Day, along with George Washington. So you have this only government thing where we celebrate two birthdays on a day which was neither man's birthday. I think in some regards, Lincoln's birthday is a sad testament to the nation's priorities. More states celebrate Black Friday than they do Lincoln's birthday. But you look at Abraham Lincoln, how do you rate him? Is he the greatest president in American history?
Yeah, I think he is. And he's the only major figure in our history in and outside of politics that was able to combine a love of learning, erudition, beautiful mastery of the English language with an authentic populist, but not just populist in the sense of political, but he actually grew up among the underclass, and he was physically could stand his own or excel people in the underclass in physical labor, muscular labor. So he had an innate empathy for soldiers, for workers. And I don't think we quite see that type of person anymore. We've lost that idea that physical work, while it can be drudgery, if you don't match it with erudition and learning, as Lincoln did, but it's also innately noble. When I drive home and when I'm on my farm and I see these guys out there at 5 in the morning on a spray rig, or I drove up here yesterday and I left at 6 and there was a guy in a D11, those huge cats, and he was tearing down an almond orchard at 5:30 in the morning. I think we've lost that element that Lincoln had.
If I gave you a chance to redo Rushmore, Victor, and gave you three other presidents to put on that mountain, who would you choose?
Three other presidents besides those who were on them. I'd probably put Madison.
Madison.
Yeah, because of his work on the Constitution and really solving early, not solving, but aware of this wonderful system, how it could be abused, and writing about factions and the idea of human nature being unchanging, and there was always going to be people who were going to try to abuse the system, and he was pretty prescient. I like James Polk because he was one-term president. I like one-term presidents.
The one and done, right.
He had a vision of sea to sea United States. And it wasn't just manifest destiny, jingoism. It was more the same type of landmass in Europe with all these different states led to constant warring, and if this country was not unified under one government, you'd have something like Europe. And then I think Reagan, I came late to Reagan. I was a registered Democrat because I grew up that way, but I remember telling my wonderful parents in 1980 I just could not vote for Jimmy Carter, and that was a shock to my family. But Reagan had an ability, and you know him much better than I did. I never met him, but he had an ability to not take offense at people who were offensive, and I don't mean that he was just passive. He dished it out like nobody else could, but he never coarsened him, I think.
Yeah, Victor, when Donald Trump was running in 2016, I told people that Donald Trump could be this generation's James K. Polk, and that Trump could entirely, at the end of one term, say, "I set out to do what I wanted to do. Yeah. I built a structure on the border. I cut taxes. I rebooted American foreign policy. I changed the nature of Washington. Drop the mic, I'm out of here. Tell me I'm onto something or tell me I'm nuts."
you're onto something with one caveat, and that is we saw that Barack Obama in 8 years was not able to get that 16-year hegemony, which with Hillary, but he did do one thing, and that is he united the party around the progressive movement. This is a guy who ran in 2008, you remember, against gay marriage and ended up, if you weren't for gay marriage, you were a heretic.
Right.
And I'm not picking on gay marriage, abortion and everything. The logical trajectory of Obamaism was the Virginia governor defending infanticide. But with Trump, he has an added dimension, is he's not only got to get elected, or somebody would have to get elected, but he would have to convince the establishment of the Republican Party that a new recalibration of trade, of immigration, of middle-class manufacturing construction is now the orthodoxy of the Republican Party. And what I feel is that they're lying in wait. As soon as he's out, they're going to try to recalibrate. So I'm not sure that he's yet institutionalized what he believes into an agenda that the way Reagan did.
I think also for Trump victory, he'd be walking away knowing the Republican establishment would like to see him go. And, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but an amateur psychologist would say that Donald Trump is somebody who clearly likes to do things motivated by people saying, you can't and should not be doing this, which I think is the whole gist of his run for president. You're a fool to run for president. You'll get creamed in New Hampshire and Iowa. You'll get drubbed by Hillary Clinton. Don't do it.
I think nobody has really solved that enigma, because the orthodox or the status quo is that Trump had a pretty good agenda in the way that 16 other of his rivals did not quite figure out, at least the calculus of the Electoral College in the Midwest, but that he marred it, or that he didn't give it full justice because of his character flaws or his grossness or his buffoonery or his tweeting. And yet he had a catharsis, a Greek term for turning up the temperature so much that other people would melt down before he did. I mean, if you're going to climb in the ring with Donald Trump, he's already been in a professional wrestling ring. It doesn't bother him. But he had an ability to just take people, whether it was John McCain or Mitt Romney or Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or the whole Never Trump Republican establishment or Elizabeth Warren, and people thought he was crude or mean. And when he got done with them, he's devastated them. And I don't know. So my point is, I'm not sure that that was not an enhancement of his agenda. And if you'd taken away the Mueller investigation, I think he would be polling about 55% right now.
Do you see any of that quality in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in that other Democrats have a hard time figuring out how to handle her? And if you go after her, she comes after you even harder on Twitter.
Yeah. It's hard to know, because she's 28. I don't know what Trump was like. I can remember him in the news, but she definitely has one good political instinct, and that's a sense of deterrent. She's trying to establish the idea that if you say she's crazy or she's immature, she's going to go after you in such a way that next time you will think it's not worth the damage that's going to accrue to you.
Right.
So she's that way. Her problem is that she's not disciplined, so that she says things that are contradictory, or this whole new Green Deal was a disaster. Green New Deal was a disaster, because she got people to sign on to it, and then she would pull the rug out from under them, and they're not going to forgive her for that, because it's going to be embarrassing that they have their fingerprints on it.
Right. Let's get back to Abraham Lincoln, who obviously never had to deal with social media. Lincoln, known for dealing with the American Civil War. And I want to read to you, Victor, a quote from a very prominent American historian. And you tell me the historian and what he's getting at. Here's the quote. Almost every cultural and social institution, universities, the public schools, the NFL, the Oscars, the Tonys, the Grammys, late-night television, public restaurants, coffee shops, movies, TV, stand-up comedy, has been not just politicized but also weaponized. The historian adds, the United States stands at the brink of a veritable civil war.
I like that guy.
Who is he?
I think something that I might have written, huh?
It's Victor Davis Hanson quoted a newspaper article of just the last week, a veritable civil war.
Yeah, what I mean is, if we stand back from all the hype and ask ourselves to look at things empirically, we have a nullification crisis every bit as serious as the one of 1826 or 1859, where we have large swaths of America, 300 sanctuary cities. California's a sanctuary state. We have such a thing called a sanctuary county, where they basically said to the federal government, immigration law, as you understand it, and it's written on the books, no longer applies. We're not going to follow it. There's not going to be any consequences, like the South did on tariffs, and then later what Wallace did as late as 62 when he said, you know, I'm not going to desegregate the schools. So that's worrisome. And then we have the use of the Ninth Circuit to stage a veritable coup against the government to stop things through court action. We've had, maybe you can remember as a better student of administrations, but I don't remember trying to abort a presidency in a way that's been so systematic. So we had the suing of the voting machines, and we had the early writs of impeachment by 60 House members. We had the Emoluments Clause. We had the 25th Amendment. We had the Logan Act, Sally Yates. Right. We've really had an effort to destroy a president, and we never had, I don't ever remember names like Johnny Depp or Madonna or Robert De Niro openly saying they would like to physically hit, kill, blow up the president.
Right.
And that anger has permeated individual families. So if you go, and I grew up in a Democratic family, so I would say that 75% of my siblings, first cousins, don't feel comfortable with
them. Right. There were plots to assassinate Lincoln before he took office.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, so there's a parallel way. But if you look at America in 1860, Victor, what you see is a nation that's on a collision course.
Yeah.
There are two economies, there's a northern economy and a southern economy. There are different societal attitudes, north and south, and there is one prevailing issue that divides, and that's slavery.
Yeah.
So it's very tempting to look at America of 2019, especially as we're sitting here in California, completely different worlds on the coast and in your Central Valley, different economies, if you will, different societal cultural attitudes. Would you say, Victor, that immigration replaces slavery now as that issue?
Well, immigration, if we just say immigration, maybe not, but if you...
Illegal immigration.
Yeah. If you say immigration in the sense that half the country feels that their message, the progressive message, does not appeal to 51% of the electorate, so it can change the electorate by doing to Arizona and Texas and Colorado what it did to New Mexico and California and Nevada. And so they deliberately want to warp the immigration system to bring in new constituents. And then the other half feels that this is aimed at them, their culture, their traditions, their history. And when you add the third force multiplier is that the immigrant does not believe that he has to assimilate, at least in the fashion of the old melting pot. In other words, he arrives from this country with automatic complaints or grievances against a country he doesn't know anything about, and yet he feels legitimate in advancing those. So, yeah, I think, and then when you add this, geography is always a force multiplier as well of revolution. And when you, north and south, but when you have two coasts, and the interior, and they're completely different. It's like Austria-Hungary or the Balkans. When people are in a physical space and they feel solidarity against another physical space, that didn't happen in the 60s. We had a lot of people talked of revolution in the 60s, but it wasn't defined by geography as a result of globalization and culture, which has happened. We've crystallized into two countries.
Right. Now, Victor, how far back do you trace your veritable civil war? I would contend that Bill Clinton is a big aim of this, the election of Bill Clinton, which starts this cycle of American politics of what, going in the opposite direction every 8 years, but one party being particularly aggrieved at the party of power, and these endless debates we have over cultural issues, social issues, government issues. I think Clinton's election is the beginning.
I think there's an argument to that because until Clinton, and that would imply, I know that LBJ was a really big government person, but when you looked at the foreign policy, the domestic policy of Hubert Humphrey, JFK, LBJ, and even people who failed, Muskie.
Right.
And there was also, and then Clinton came, and there was also a sense that if you were a northerner and you weren't going to be elected after Kennedy if you did not have a southern accent. There was that burden on the Democratic Party that if you ran a Dukakis or you ran a McGovern, they were going to lose. If you ran an LBJ or Clinton or Al Gore, you were going to win the popular vote because that was a reassurance that you weren't crazy.
Right.
And Clinton took that, and then he ran on a, at least up until the 94 compromise and all that. But after 95, he decided it was time to take off the the veneer and to be what he was, and he was a hardcore progressive. And he, the other thing is that he didn't play by the Marquess of Queensberry rules, the war room and all. They were vicious, and that, and the Republicans didn't know how to. Last time a Republican campaign like Clinton was Lee Atwater in '88, and we haven't seen that Republicans do that. They wanted to win. They wanted to lose nobly rather than to win ugly. At least I felt McCain and Romney did. And they were not up to the new Democratic progressive machine that really thought any means necessary or okay for the anointed end of social justice.
Let me offer you, Victor, another theory for the beginning of the Civil War, the continuity of it, which would be the Internet and social media.
Yeah.
The Internet going back about 20 years in terms of force, Clinton's. So the Star Report is the first time I remember really being dependent upon the Internet, because you could go online and go to the Washington Post and read the document in its entirety.
Yeah.
So now the Internet's around. But then the last decade, social media, Twitter in particular, yes, being able to share whatever dark thought you have, yes, and having these anonymous flame fights constantly.
Yeah, I agree. This idea that we have an electronic lynch mob that,
right,
almost the race is to be the first to post and to be the most venomous to post and even to be the most anonymous. So you're not responsible for the consequences of your lynching. But, and then we have, you know, any thought we have, we can get our smartphones out. That was a big development, having not a laptop but a smartphone, that you had some knowledge of the planet instantaneously retrievable.
Right.
And so if a guy in Selma where I live said something that was illiberal, who cared? But all of a sudden that could get on to a blog, and that would be a referendum on America's morality and sanity. But the other thing I think that I didn't recognize is that we created these trust monopolies, conglomerates, Facebook, Google, Yahoo, Twitter, and we didn't learn about the railroads, the oil, the sugar trust of the past, that when you give so much money, and they're the wealthiest people in the history of civilization, and so much power, and they have an ideology, especially a scary one in the sense that they can mask their corporate greed or their effort to corner markets by kind of flip-flops and tie-dye shirts, mm-hmm, that there was no restraint on them. And so the Republicans always said, you can't break up trust, we have a free market, the robber barons were great.
Right.
And the Democrats will say, well, we might have wanted to be muckrakers, but these guys are our guys. And the result is that they've warped searches, they contaminate social media, they censor people. So they're a very, very strong, potent political force on the left. I think they run the left now.
Have you thought about a world in which Hillary Clinton is the president and not Donald Trump in terms of the Civil War in this respect, Victor? If Hillary is sitting in the Oval Office and not Trump, we don't have award shows. You know, we don't have the Tonys and the Grammys and the Oscars just becoming relentless complaints about society and how dark it is, and we have to stand up. The Washington Post is not making money it is right now in what darkness and all that. The New York Times, which is having wonderful turnaround economically, they owe it to Donald Trump. With Hillary in office, Republicans, yes, they suffer from the derangement syndrome that Democrats have right now, but are things at the same level as they are with Trump?
Well, I would think if Hillary had been elected, the Civil War would have been begun and ended instantaneously. In other words, we wouldn't have any disagreement because given the Obama precedence of everything from bypassing the Senate to do an Iran treaty or the executive orders or amnesties, she would have used those same mechanisms, and it would have been not just 4 of Obama, but 8 of Obama, but 12 of Hillary, and probably 16
right.
years. And I could, the Grammys, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, they wouldn't even have been controversial.
Right.
It would have been like FDR. That was a doctrinaire ideology, and we all had to, in various. That was what was so weird about the Goldwater than Reagan. They had told the country, you don't know that you're asleep, and that FDRism and the liberal project has failed, and there is such a thing as conservatism. And I think we would have had to have some figure like that, because they would have institutionalized the Obama approach, whether it was the EPA, we would have been solar, wind, we would have never been pumping 3 million barrels more of oil today than we were when Trump got elected.
Right.
It just wasn't going to happen.
But with Hillary in office, Victor, we don't have this phrase, the resistance. We don't have this phrase called the resistance.
No.
There is a resistance, though it's a conservative resistance, yeah. Republican resistance. I would argue Republicans probably have control of both chambers of commerce right now, of Congress, if she is in office, because yeah. you would not have had the same turnout in 2018. But it's a different America in this regard in terms of where the energy and anger is. Is there still a civil war, though?
Yeah, I think there is. They would be, well, I mean, it wasn't going to be won by the right, but they would right. be relegated. They wouldn't be called the resistance. They wouldn't even be called the deplorables. They would be called the racists, the sexists, the homophobes, mm-hmm. the xenophobes, the nativists, the protectionists. So I don't see that how they would coalesce. And they would be, if you take Trump out of this situation, or right. even had what would be the anecdote to all that? I don't think that they'd lost 5 out of 6 of the last popular votes,
mm-hmm.
and they hadn't won 51% of any election, I think, until George H.W. Bush in 1988. He was the last person to get 51%.
Right.
So they didn't really have a compelling message that could capture the Electoral College anymore. And I don't know what they would have done, but I doubt that they would have gone to this Jacksonian Trumpism workers, which was the only salvation for them. I just don't think they would have done it. I think they would have said, you know what, I want to lose nobly with a sober and judicious Jeb Bush. He'll get about 46%, 45% of the popular vote. He'll get killed in the Electoral College, but he will run a very noble campaign, and will just be a kind of, remember the House Speaker for 40 years, Bob Michaels?
Mm-hmm.
He's a perfect, nice gentleman. He was a wonderful person, and he was just the institutionalization of a loser that had no ambitions of ever taking over.
Exactly. But what about yet another alternate universe victor in which a Republican's elected in 2016, but it's not Donald Trump, but it's a, oh, I hate to use this word because it's not friendly, but it's a milquetoasty Republican like a Marco Rubio or a Jeb Bush,
yeah.
somebody who just is not Donald Trump.
Yeah.
What happens in the resistance? I imagine you still have the award shows complaining about the Republican yeah. in office, because that Republican's still going to put horrible people on the Supreme Court and stand for things we don't stand for. But in terms of this intensity you've seen since Trump came to office, is the fire still there?
Yeah, and I think they were, each of these figures you mentioned was getting closer to the center, maybe not Ted Cruz. So if you look at these judicial appointments that you referenced,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't just Brennan, and it wasn't in the past Earl Warren, but it was Sandra Day O'Connell, a very good judge, but moderate. It was John Roberts. It was the effort to get
right.
Harriet Myers. It was Souter. We were going to get somebody like that. And Trump had enough cunning and instinct to outsource that to the Federalist Society. I don't think they would have done that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would have thought, you know what? It's going to be so calamitous. And do we really want to go through Robert Bork again? Where if you told Trump, hey, they're going to do to Robert Bork, or they're going to do to your nominee what they did to Bork, his natural reaction was, good, let's see who wins. I'll enjoy it. He likes that combativeness, and they were from a culture, they've been acculturated to think that the worst thing you can do is be called a name by, the left had really prepped the battlefield and created a sense of deterrence so that they were calling the shots.
All right. One other characteristic of the era of the Civil War, Victor, is how both parties find themselves having to sort of constantly change positions when it comes to what you call it, moral convictions. In the 1990s, for example, Republicans go after Bill Clinton on impeachment.
Yeah.
And yes, the charge was perjury, but this is driven mostly by personal behavior. Here we are now, 20 years later, and Democrats are going after Donald Trump. If they don't find collusion, which I doubt they will, they're going to go after him basically on what? Personal behavior. Yeah. So there's a shift. Let's look at the Commonwealth of Virginia,
yeah.
where you have a governor right now. I'm interested in your thoughts on that, by the way, but a governor who is being pressured to be run out of office for a past indiscretion,
yeah.
which is what? Being caught on picture, being caught on camera wearing blackface. You have other Democrats standing by his side. At the same time, you have Democrats who want Brett Kavanaugh out of the way for past activities. In other words, it seems that you're just sort of constantly just trying to refigure where you stand morally on issue based on what? Whose ox is gored?
Yeah. Well, the Democrats added a twist to that because they created two new addenda, and one was statute of limitations no longer apply on anything.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
second, there is no such thing as due process.
Right.
So once they went down that route, they found out that, say, Fairfax, for example.
Right. This Lieutenant Governor Fairfax is yes. accused of sexual
assault.
It
doesn't matter if it was 15 years ago or 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter whether there was corroborating evidence.
Right.
he's guilty.
Right.
And they never thought that that was going to happen.
You have Democrats who think he should go, but you also had Democrats, you know, Kavanaugh saying he should go as well. But then you have other Democrats saying Fairfax should not go until something's been proven. Whereas the Democrats say Kavanaugh should go.
Their point is they will massage the argument if it gets down to the fourth person, a Republican.
Right.
So they'll come up with all sorts of – I think one of their arguments, and they can't figure it out, is a proven indiscretion of the past – and that's what blackface is. It's a racist indiscretion – worse than an unproven felonious act. And that's what Fairfax is. They can't figure that out. And then they've opened a can of worms in this intersectionality. We don't know what to do now with Jimmy Kimmel, who not only wore blackface, but he, in a very cruel way, he made fun of Carl Malone in a skit.
Right.
Joy Behar. It's all. What do we do with all this stuff that keeps coming out? If you've established that there's no statute of limitations, and these are thought crimes or cultural crimes, and they're tantamount to legal crimes, so I think it's really destroy them. I'm just thinking of all these people, Elizabeth Warren, who culturally appropriated somebody's identity, said she never profited, then did profit from it, to Joe Biden now. We found out 1975, he kind of gave an argument for segregation the other day about when he worked for Robert Byrd, or he helped Robert Byrd pass an anti-busing bill. And does that mean he's a racist? Because, you know, 40 years, 50 years ago, and they started all of this idea, and they always thought it was going to be Manichaean. There was going to be a Covington white, swarmy little Catholic supposed kid,
right,
and then a noble elder of the tribe. And that's not the way the world works. And they're now hoisted on their own petards. And I don't know. It's been the great and the so-called Green New Deal and the abortion problem, infanticide. They've been just turkeys on a platter to Trump,
right?
And he just has to sit back and just—he can do what he's in the driver's seat on that, I think.
Right. So the joke with Joe Biden, Victor, back in the day, this is back in 1987, the first time he runs for president, and that campaign is undone in part by a health crisis, but also because it's revealed that he's been plagiarizing in his speeches, and he rips off two people in particular.
Yes.
One is Bobby Kennedy.
Yep.
So, okay, you're a Democrat, you can rip off a Kennedy, that's smart. But the other person he rips off? Neil Kinnock. And that was the joke around Washington circles, Victor. My God, all the British politicians in the world you could rip off.
Marxist laborer.
Yeah, Neil Kinnock.
And then he had a trifecta where he, as I remember, and my memory may be sketchy, but he, that 87, he was campaigning. He also lied in inserting, saying that his family had been coal miners.
Yes.
None of them had been. And then he said, when he was pressed on it, he said, I know more than you do. I'm wiser than you do. I went to law school on a scholarship, which he didn't.
Right.
And so he's considered, he's leading the polls, he's considered their moderate candidate. But when you actually go look at him, whether it's Put You All Back in Chains or Barack Obama's the first articulate black person, that was really a shocking thing to say, because that meant that people like Senator Brooke or Barbara Jordan were not articulate. They were brilliant people.
Right.
And then the donut comment about Indian Americans in donut shops, and then everybody should, George Bush should get on the TV like FDR did in 1929 when he wasn't president and there weren't not TVs. So he's a, and then I'm going to take the president behind the gym and beat the blank out.
Right.
He's a very unstable person. He always has been. Anytime he's been in a position of authority and spotlight, and remember the Bork hearings, he's been a disaster. That's why I think in 2008, Barack Obama said, is there anything this he won't say? Will somebody stop him saying stupid stuff? And there was a talk, you remember, they thought about pulling him in 2012. If that's what the Democrats have, I think they're in trouble.
I look at the Biden 2020 campaign, Victor, and I see a one of two things. Democratic consultants have asked anonymously about his candidacy, crap on it. They think he's overrated and he's doomed to fail. Given what consultants said in 2016 about Trump, that makes me think, my God, he's probably going to get the nomination.
Yeah.
Just when in doubt, what a consultant says, go the opposite direction. The other school of thought, though, Victor, is that he's Ed Muskie. Ed Muskie runs in 1972. He is Humphrey's running mate in 1968. In 1972, he's a senator from Maine. He is the front runner in Democratic polls, and he's seen as the likely nominee, and he collapses in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
He's just kind of a paper tiger, and he's also taken out in part because the Democratic Party is having a much larger conversation, a much bigger internal fight over who the Democrats are, and it leads to this very angry convention in Miami.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to get the nomination for a couple of reasons, in addition to the one that scenario, the latter scenario, and that is that he's 76, I think, now. He'd be 78 years old, and he's starting to lose his vigor. He's in an age of Me Too, so he has a disturbing, I don't want to be gross, but he has a creepy habit of holding women too long and touching them too, and having that on video in the age of Me Too. And then the other thing that he's run for president twice, mm-hmm. and both of those campaigns were car wrecks. I mean, they were utter disasters. So I think had Barack Obama not rescued him, he wouldn't be a serious person. The fact that he was vice president, and you have so many minority candidates. With Obama, you had one, and he unified it. But now we've got everybody. We've got Booker, we've got Harris, we've got some Latino candidates, we have more coming in, and he's the old white moderate, and that's what he's going to be running on. Sort of like Hillary did remember when Hillary said in 2008, she said, I got the white vote, and you have to have the white vote. She denies it, that now, but she actually said it. So Biden is thinking that he's going to be the only person that's the white working class. He cannot beat Trump with a white working class. I just don't think that's possible. So I think his forte is bogus.
It's an interesting point about the Me Too thing. I was thinking about this the other day, Victor, and reading a column by Willie Brown, who was the longtime California Assembly Speaker, the famous Ayatollah of the Assembly, then a mayor of San Francisco. But Willie must be well up into his 80s by now, Victor. And he punches out a column every week for the Chronicle. Willie dated Kamala Harris back in the 1990s. And there was an age difference of, I think he was 60 and she was 29 at the time. And here is Willie writing in the Chronicle about, there's nothing here to see, folks. This is all perfectly normal. And I thought, what a perfectly tone-deaf thing in this day and age for an old man to be saying that.
Either that or it was what the Roman rhetoricians called praetoritio, and that was, how do you get something dirty in by, I will not, as for my opponent's fact that he was a thief and a rat, I don't want to mention that, it would be untoward, but when he said, and I dated her, and as for the fact that I pointed her to two boards right out of law school, I won't want to mention that. As to the fact that she was ungracious and said that she would indict me if I crossed, I don't want to really think that's. And he managed, for someone who was ostensibly writing a column on her behalf, to bring in every negative thing he could.
He wrote about her twice. I made a joke to a friend the other day that he wrote a column on the day of the Super Bowl. And I told a friend that here's how Kamala Harris spent her Super Bowl Sunday. She got up in the morning, she called donors and checked in with them. And then before the game, she called Willie Brown and said, Willie, I love you, but please stop writing about me. You're killing me very quickly.
It's not a feminist thing to do to have Willie Brown tell people basically that your career was jump-started by having an affair with a married man. It just doesn't, it's not, even in today's America, it's not feminist to do that.
Victor, the American Civil War in the 1860s ended after four very bloody years, the Union wearing down the Confederacy. How does the Second Civil War, how does this current Civil War, if we're going to actually have a full-blown Civil War, I guess you say we're on the verge of it, how does the Civil War end?
Well, I think one side wins and one side loses. The one side, the traditionalists will say that America is a good nation, and the fact that it is not and has not been perfect in its past is irrelevant. You don't have to be perfect to be good. It's economy, it's constitutional stability, it's military force, it's higher education. All of these things are preeminent. And people will come to this country, and they will intermarry, and they will assimilate, and they will integrate, and their last name, their religion, their color, their skin will be incidental, not essential to their personas. Mm-hmm. Or we're going to go down the Rwanda, Iraq, tribal balkanization of the country, where we're going to be so confused by our DNA and our hyphenated names, and we're going to have competing grievances and victim groups, that it's going to be something socially like the Balkans, or culturally sort of like Europe in the sense of big government, high taxation, lethargy, a youth that doesn't marry, doesn't buy a home, doesn't have children, or economically it'll be like Venezuela. But one side is going to win and one side is going to lose.
Okay.
I kind of hedged I try to load the comparison because I think
right.
The left side is a prescription for oblivion.
I'm just curious as to how long the fire can go, Victor. If Donald Trump wins in 2020, which I would probably lay odds on right now, just looking at the Democratic field and the things you mentioned about the past week and just bad for the Democrats. But let's paint America in the next 4 years under Donald Trump. He'll get probably 3 Supreme Court appointments, Victor.
Yeah.
He would Ruth Bader Ginsburg. God forbid something happens to her, but she's 85 years old right now and not in good health, so he maybe gets that pick. Stephen Breyer is right behind her. Clarence Thomas. We forget about Clarence Thomas, but he'd be wise to step down too. He'll have 3 more picks on the court, so that's 3 times where Democratic heads will explode, especially if he picks a replacement for RBG. You could have the Democrats gaining the Senate in 2020, in which case now the Supreme Court nominations become a fight. But just the presence of Trump in the White House for the next 4 years, just what are celebrities going to do? What's the hate Trump, the never Trump industry going to do for 4 more years?
Well, I think he understands that, and I think now what he's starting to do is what you mentioned. He's trying to institutionalize his agenda in a way that Obama never did. So the Supreme Court would be one of them. All of these federal lower courts and appellate courts, he's
right.
Flooding them, and they're being very successful in getting confirmed. I think he really does believe if you close the borders and you go from 1 million illegal people coming in without education, a high school diploma, skills, capital, legality, and you recalibrate that as 250,000 from all over the world that are diverse, measured, educated, then you've solved this identity politics because the process of assimilation will start to work again, and that will destroy this blue plan of the American Southwest and to flip the Electoral College from that region. So I think he's looking at energy, and he's saying, you know what? I have divorced ourselves strategically from any influence on the Gulf states and Russia.
Right.
I have done more to emasculate Vladimir Putin by flooding the world with oil and making us not dependent and selling natural gas. So I think he's got people who are looking at strategically how do you enhance the United States in general and his agenda in particular after he's gone. So that's what he's trying to do. FDR did it. Reagan was the first person to question that whole project. And even Reagan found out. Reagan got a lot of brilliant people that came in that were going to save the world, and by the second term we stopped the growth of it, or we stopped the damage, but they can't undo the administrative state.
Now, one place where Trump has a lot of judges to potentially fill is California.
Yes.
Now, he hasn't paid a lot of attention out here, actually, and he should be thinking about that. Big news day in California today. Victor Gavin Newsom, the newly elected governor, gives his first State of the State address in Sacramento. And the governor makes news. And the headline is Gavin Newsom saying, "I'm not Jerry Brown." And he breaks with Jerry Brown on 2 matters. One is the Twin Tunnel. This is a water plan to ferry water from the Sacramento Bay Delta down south. Jerry Brown wanted 2 gigantic tunnels to make this transfer. It's something he's been after for 40 years and has failed at. Newsom favors only 1 water tunnel. This is a much more Northern California environmental view of the world. But the other news, and really the bigger headline, is that Gavin Newsom is pulling away from the high-speed rail project, and that he does not want the plan to work from Los Angeles to San Francisco, but he does want to keep high-speed rail in effect, Victor, in your Central Valley.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the Central Valley in California. If I'm trying to rejuvenate, empower the economy in the Central Valley, is a high-speed train the way to start?
No, it's not cost-benefit analysis. In a cost-benefit analysis, it doesn't work. That thing was $3 billion. It's up to $12, $15. Most people think it'll be $30 from Bakersfield.
Bakersfield to Merced, I think, what they're talking about.
Even then, they rationalized. It was sold to us. You guys need the money down there. You're a bunch of hicks. You want the $100 million or whatever it will be. But it won't work for you unless it goes over Pacheco Pass, mm-hmm. unless it gets into the L.A. Basin. So we're going to do this, set it up, and then you can work in Silicon Valley and live in Madera, or you can work in San Fernando Valley and live in Tulare. And that's not going to happen. It never was. So mm-hmm. if you'd taken the same amount of money, we have this six-lane 99, and we have a 40-mile stretch outside of Visalia to Delano. It's a death. And it's the most dangerous stretch of freeway in the United States per miles driven, per capita death rate. And we have four-lane bottleneck for 40 miles. We could have solved that problem. We also have an Amtrak line that is actually pretty good. It goes all the way to Bakersfield. Mm-hmm. The problem with it is it doesn't have two tracks. So you get on the train, you want to go to Sacramento, and you sit there for 20 minutes. Or if you're driving cross-country, as I do, I hit a train that's sitting on the tracks.
Right.
And so for just a fraction of that money, they could have built a parallel Amtrak. They already had the right-of-way. And so what they did is, here's the 99, next to it's the Amtrak, and they built a third corridor because this thing couldn't have the dramatic curves, had to be straight, and they took all of these beautiful ancestral oaks in the Lemoore Hanford farming area. They completely waived EPA rights. They destroyed some of the best farmland in that area. They broke up people's ancestral ranches, and it was all duplicitous. They built sort of a stone hedge, big overpass over 99 and 41, so when you drive by, you saw these placards, your high-speed rail at work. But it was a Potemkin village concept. There was not one track rail. So you'd see people say, wow, I just drove to Fresno, and they're going over the 99. It looks like they got a mile of that most expensive, and you think, wow, if they can do this, and the easy stuff's done. But the easy stuff was never started. They haven't laid 1 foot of track. And so they built just highly visible propaganda sort of things, and they salted the money, conservative construction company. So you had this bizarre political situation where you go talk to your conservative assemblymen, such as they were, and they'd say, well, now don't be hasty about high-speed rail, because so many of their contributors were invested in it.
Right. So Newsom, by doing this, Victor, first of all, shows that he's not Jerry Brown.
Not Jerry Brown.
And they're very different men to begin with. Newsom is 29 years younger than Jerry Brown. It's the biggest age difference in California governors since Brown replaced Ronald Reagan.
I didn't know that.
1975, yeah. It's a huge generational shift. They're both from San Francisco, but Jerry Brown is the famous Jesuit student, whereas Gavin Newsom is a product of kind of, you know, flashy modern-day tech San Francisco. But he, by doing this, he does show he's not Jerry, but he's also symbolically Victor reaching out to the Central Valley. Newsom made a point of this during the campaign, to go to the Central Valley and say, I care about you. I will come back. I've written about this myself, saying that, you know, okay, go back and prove it. After his election, he did go back. So now he's saying symbolically, I care about you with this train. But again, the question, Victor, is if he really wants to help the Central Valley, what does he do?
If he wanted to help the Central Valley,
And I think this is important because we talk about at all times, the two parties reaching out and doing things out of the convention. This is a good question. If a very coastal blue, Newsom is a metrosexual, bluer than blue Democrat.
Yeah.
And we'll find a Democrat spends more time bashing Trump than this guy. He's a product of San Francisco. He's grown up in about a 60-mile radius from Marin County down to Santa Clara. He can't get bluer than this, Victor. So, again, if he wants to show that it's not just lip service that I care about this more conservative part of California, what does he do?
There's about four or five things that would be popular. It would be affect people's lives in a really dramatic way. The first thing, of course, is finish the six-lane 99 and finish the Amtrak. Mm-hmm. And then second, all of our power rates are set by coastal people. We're sitting in a studio, even on a cold day like this, it's probably 60 degrees. When I go home, it's 29 at night. And in the summer, it's 110. And people are going to Walmart to get the free air conditioning because they can't afford to turn it. So 30 cents a kilowatt hour, and that's because of these mandates. He's got to find a way to open up energy markets and allow people reasonable rates. He's got to address the gas. We're paying a dollar more gas than people in Michigan, of all places. So he's got to make people have to drive a long way. It's more affordable. He's got to do something, even though I think there's a 40 million people in the state, only 160,000 pay half the income tax. But nevertheless, on terms of sales taxes, it's very high. Property tax, the rate's not exorbitant, but the evaluation is such that.
Right.
So he's got to encourage home ownership, construction of homes, affordable homes, and that's either by relaxing the regulations and zoning and the environmentalists. So ultimately, he's going to have to stand up to the Silicon Valley-funded green lobby and say, you know what, no more high-speed rail. I want freeways. I want the old rail to be upgraded. I want reasonable power. I want reasonable fuel. I want to frack. I want to do this. I want to help agriculture. You see that what the subtext of both of the items you mentioned is money. Mm-hmm. And he knows more than Jerry Brown that you don't have enough money, so you split the difference. You can't build high-speed rail because you'll go broke, so you'll allow a little bit in the valley. You can't have two tunnels, but you'll let the west side guys have one tunnel. And it's splitting the difference in a way that won't bankrupt the state, he thinks. But the $64,000 question is he astute enough to know as a business person himself that he himself couldn't do business under the state as it existed without an old boy network and private capital and cronyism? And what I'm getting at is, will he address the fundamental problems? How do you get a 4% GDP growing economy when the national economy is doing well? And that means deregulate, more energy, more realism on environmental legislation. You don't let 50 million acre feet out to the ocean when you're one drought year away from water rationing, when you have three dams at sites in Los Banos Grandes and Temperance Flat with six million acre feet you could build for 15 miles of the high-speed rail. I mean, if he could see that,
right,
then he would be sort of like Pat Brown Sr.
Yeah.
He could be very popular.
So the two things about the Newsom governorship that I think people outside of California should look for, Victor. First of all, when in doubt, government to the rescue.
Yeah.
It's just an endless supply of government solutions. We're going to start pre-K programs, give everybody in California a chance to send their little kiddies into school the earliest chance they can get. We're going to expand Medi-Cal for everybody in the state up to age 26, including illegal immigrants. We're just going to expand government. We're going to throw more money at you. We're going to put more money into education. Secondly, when it comes to every thorny problem we have, homelessness, you name it, we're just going to have a bunch of smart people get in a room and figure out what to do. Now, on the one hand, Victor, maybe smart people could come up with a solution. On the other hand, you could be looking at what is paralysis by analysis.
Yeah. That's predicated on the idea that since 1980, the estimates are very hard to find, but there's probably about 10 million first and second generation Californians that are not here now,
right,
that have left for no or low tax states. Mm-hmm. And then second, we've never seen this concentration of money before in Silicon Valley, Hollywood, mm-hmm, high tech. And then third, everybody says, well, there's only 300,000 coming from Mexico and Central America. There's only 200, but it's aggregate. So we've got aggregate probably 10 million people who've come and their children. And what the result of all that is, we're a medieval society without a middle class. So Newsom operates on the principle that the wealthy people are wealthy enough. They don't mind the taxes and all that, but they do want these utopian agendas that he gives them. And the consequences of those agendas have driven out the middle class, which he doesn't – that's not his constituency. It's the very wealthy who finance him, and it's the very poor that are the subject of entitlements. And the question is, when you have a state that's 40% Latino, second and third generation, and – many of them are starting to get outside of government. They're not just in the DMV working, but they're in small businesses, landscaping, construction, labor contractors, but now even everything. At some point, do they emulate the values and the concerns of the departed old white middle class? And if that's true, and I think you're starting to see a little bit of it, then I think you might see a correction. I don't think Newsom is as stupid as Dianne Feinstein, Kamala Harris, to start attacking Catholics as the way they did during that nomination hearing for a federal judge. If they were to continue that, it would really turn off the Latino population. You don't go in California, you don't attack, as Kamala Harris did, the Knights of Columbus. Where I am, the Catholic Church, the Knights of Columbus are all Hispanic. And I think that he's understanding that a little bit, but if he's going to be a Kamala Harris or a traditional Bay Area liberal, then he's assuming that it's a medieval society that will never have a middle class.
Final question for you, Victor. Something you didn't mention in terms of Central Valley problems, but how do we resolve illegal immigration in the Central Valley?
Well, you start with a recognition that when you bring in millions of people, not from northern Mexico as when I was growing up, but from the poorest regions of Central America and Oaxaca, mm-hmm. Chiapas, then you're asking the Latino community to have schools that cannot offer advanced placement if they have bilingual education. You're telling a third-generation Hispanic person who's 15 years old that somebody from the Norteños or the Sureños gang may not like him mm-hmm. because he's a Twinkie or something. And you're telling neighborhoods that have enormous crime problems that it's racist to put somebody and turn them over to ICE. And so I think you have to start with the idea that bringing in anybody illegally without English, without skill sets, and expecting them to be rotated. So you bring them in, they become 50 years old, they've been on a ladder, they've been on a roof, they've been working with cement, they're hurt, and then you dump them on the entitlement and you bring in their replacement at 18. That sort of doesn't work anymore, and we've got to stop that. I'm not for guest workers at all.
Right.
Just bite the bullet and have immigration that is diverse. It's got to be diverse from South Korea, from Finland, not just from south of the border. It's got to be diverse. It's got to be legal. It's got to be measured. Only bring in enough people, probably around 200,000, that we can assimilate quickly and rapidly. And we have to have some idea it's meritocratic, so that a PhD in neurosurgery from, the Punjab doesn't wait 8 years while somebody's third cousin comes across the border illegally and gets amnesty. And that's hard to do because, just to finish, the Democratic Party, I mean, I remember when I was in high school, Cesar Chavez had this weird program where they went down the border and beat people coming across the border. His idea was that I'm not going to let foreign nationals destroy my union, even though they were, and they used the word wetback. It was very right. ironic. But the point I'm getting at is that they've got to change the dialectics of illegal immigration. They've got to say it's illiberal, it's immoral, it privileges one group over another group, it makes people who don't have a lot of money pay for entitlements, it's cynical. If the first thing you do when you cross into a country is break the law, and the second thing you do is break another law by residing in that country, then everything from identity theft to not registering car is that much easier.
Okay, actually, I lied. Final question. Which concerns you more, the one-party ironclad rule government in Sacramento or the volatile two-party power-shifting government in Washington?
Oh, we still have a chance in the United States, but when you have a one-party, you're on the road to Venezuela with a one-party rule, and that's what we have in California. And we really do. We only have 7 Republican Congress people. No, not one Republican statewide office. And more importantly, no immediate hope that that's going to change.
No, it's not. I was pointing this out to a reporter. One reason why Newsom could do what he did on high-speed rail was it not only is it not fair as fellow Democrats, not a Republican on the horizon to challenge him unless there's some Arnold Schwarzenegger-like fellow who's going to appear magically, which I don't think could happen.
They changed the demography. They drove out the middle class. And they one final thing is, it was one of the most brilliant things the left did was they redefined affirmative action, which had been designed for the exploitation and terrible treatment of African Americans. And they, under Obama, they rebranded it as diversity. And it wasn't predicated on showing need or class consideration. You could be an orthodontist and be Punjabi or Egyptian. Mm-hmm. And it just basically was kind of a racialist idea that if you're not white, you're part of a 30%, not 12, 30% collective that has legitimate grievances because they, whether they're a lathe maker in Ohio or washing cars in Pennsylvania, they, if they're white, have privilege and they're supremacists. That was a radical thing to do because it really polarized the country and it divorced race from past exploitation. I just don't believe that somebody from Chile who sets foot in the United States and has a Spanish name instantly gets to have grievances and set-asides and affirmative action in a way that somebody had to grow up like Clarence Thomas under Jim Crow.
I remember the lawsuit from years back where a fellow from South Africa applied to Georgetown
yeah.
and put down African on his on his admission form, and Georgetown would not accept him as an African student because he's from South Africa. Yeah. His point was, I'm on the continent. Well, no, you're not what we think. I was an African.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me, Bill.
Well, Victor, I enjoyed the conversation. And what are you working on next?
I worked on a 3-book contract with Basic Books. I did a book on World War II. I just finished a book that comes out 2 weeks called The Case for Trump. Case is a very broad term. How he got elected, whether just the issues that we talked about. Will he get reelected? Has he changed things? And was he preferable to the alternative? And then I have a book on the history of war, the idea of war, and what's the future of it? Will it be eliminated? And so then I'll be 66, and I think it's time to take a break.
I'd like to do a separate podcast with you on just how you find the time to do all this, but then you probably don't have the time to do that podcast. Yeah.
Well, it's called Not Having a Life.
Victor Davis Hanson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, spread the word. Convince your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Victor Davis Hanson and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Victor Davis Hanson is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @VDHanson. That is @VDHanson. Hanson with an O. @VDHanson. He also has a website, Victor Davis Hanson Private Papers, and the website for that is www.victorhanson.com. I mentioned his columns. You can find those both online and at the Hoover website as well. And he's just a joy to talk to. Thanks again, Victor.
Thank you.
We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. As always, thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.